This is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. More arrests, more vandalism. Napuama County has been moving wind turbines into place at its job site in Kahuku. But police report vandals have tried to damage the equipment over the weekend, and they're asking for the public's help to hold those responsible accountable for their actions. This morning, we talked with Sherry Minor McNamara of the Hawaii Chamber of Commerce about the escalation of criminal property damage.
We are concerned as to what it will portray Hawaii as a place to do business. We believe Hawaii needs outside investment so that we can continue to grow a healthy economy. And so what's going on now, we're definitely concerned of what that will do to future investment. We believe in civil disobedience. We believe in the constitutional right to protest. However, when it goes beyond that, that's where we have a concern. And, you know, we're closely watching what is going on. And I think we really need to start being more deliberate and thoughtful as to what we need to do to address what's going on and how can we address the issues but do it in a very thoughtful, collaborative way.
The protesters believe that they're protecting the aina, but what does it say when we see those acts of vandalism with what happened overnight with the turbine and then also what happened last week with the power pole getting cut?
We can understand some of the reasons, and when you look back at the history as well as what has transpired, we understand and we need to learn and respect the culture and ensuring that, and we need to honor the culture and respect our communities, but while ensuring opportunities for future generations. But when we start going beyond the civil disobedience and going beyond what we're seeing right now, that raises concerns. And, you know, with these projects, they have followed the process. And in some of these projects, such as TMT, need to follow the rule of law, whether we like the decision or not. That's the rule of law, and it needs to be upheld. And once we go against that, then who knows what could happen? And do we as a state, can we afford that? And we cannot afford that. We're looking, we have discussions about diversification. We have discussions for years about that. We have clean energy goals. We have affordable housing issues, cost of living. And so here we are encouraging projects, encouraging investment, encouraging initiatives to address these areas. But yet, if we have obstruction to these projects that will help address these areas, then that raises concerns because now we're looking at the impact on our communities and the livelihood of our state.
Law enforcement has stepped up, and they're asking for the public's help in solving these crimes. The protesters, I think, are trying to distance themselves from the folks that are actually behind those acts of vandalism. The protesters believe what they're doing is protecting the aina, that they are using kapu aloha and nonviolence. But, you know, certainly I think when you have instances where public safety might be involved, particularly with the power lines getting cut, the power pole, that's a concern.
Oh, absolutely. Anytime there's an issue relating to health and safety, it does really raise the red flag. And we hope that these actions will not escalate. We do encourage discussions. We do encourage people to raise their concerns, express their perspectives, because that's important. That's part of the process. But when we start impacting the health and safety of our communities, of the people, then that certainly is something that we cannot endorse. And so we need to have, and I guess this is the lesson moving forward, but step back and look at what's going on now. And moving forward, we need to start listening more to each other. We need to engage with each other. We need to connect with each other and talk with each other. But with the current situation, this is not happening. And again, going back to the rule of law, going back to the process, it's been done, and we need to accept and move forward. And there'll be other challenges as well, and there'll be other issues. And so if we can learn from what's going on now and apply it to future challenges and issues, then hopefully we can change the conversation and the mindset and the dynamics of the discussions.
Have you had a chance to talk to officials with AES?
Not with AES directly.
The company has contributed, I think, like $4.5 million in community benefits to offset the impact of those windmills. I'm just wondering how they're looking at this, you know, display of pushback from the community.
Yeah, you know, we know that companies in Hawaii, and we're a small island state, and we share a sense of community, and we're optimistic that the companies and local business here want, and those who want to do business in Hawaii will value and share the respect we have for community as well. And I guess when we see when in what AES has done and listen to the process and providing these benefits, and hopefully will continue to provide benefits in other ways, we hope that we can look at the broader picture of how these benefits will benefit the community as a whole and our state.
The power outage, I think, impacted some businesses there on the North Shore. You know, I heard there was a surf meet that was canceled. You know, people were out of power for a while. Down over in Waimanalo when they had the demonstration with the Sherwood Forest and the park plans over there, I think there was vandalism on the construction equipment that was left on site. Mm-hmm. And I think it just raises some concerns about, you know, what could happen up on Mauna Kea.
There's been a lot of discussion about the economic impact. And yes, that's definitely important, but we need to, it has a much broader impact. It has social impact, education impact, a community impact. So while there's always been discussion about the economic impact, we need to think more broader as to how this will impact today as well as the future. You know, again, we need to look at it holistically and in a very a much broader picture as to how it's going to affect the communities today as well as the way our communities will be formed tomorrow as well and the future generations to come.
Do you think that if the state had moved quicker to deal with Mauna Kea, that we wouldn't be in this position that we're in?
That's been part of the dialogue, that if the state had moved quicker, then you know, we may not be in this situation. But I think we need to start focusing and now moving ahead. What can we do? It's too late to correct the action or inaction. And I hope this is a lesson learned that we need to be respecting each other's views. And while we may not agree, we hear that, we may not agree, but can we at least move forward? And we need to do that. We're at a critical juncture in our state, and there's so many challenges out there. And if we want to continue to address these challenges and build a better future for Hawaii, we cannot do it the way that is going on now and the way it's been done in the past.
I believe the governor and the mayor are still out of town, but has there been any effort to have a meeting of the minds, you know, with private sector and the government leaders?
At this point, there has not been a call for a meeting of the minds. And if in the future they do call a meeting, we are all in, because we need to be part of this effort. And it's not only a public issue, it's a private issue, it's a community issue, it's a statewide issue. And we need to all be in this together and discuss these critical and serious issues that are presented to us today.
It sounds like because there are so many pieces, I guess, that need to be transported over to the North Shore, that this is really going to be kind of a long and drawn-out scenario.
That's part of the process. You know, if there is another way to bring the equipment in a faster, more efficient way, then obviously that would have been done. But this is this current situation. And again, by the rule of law, following the process, once public safety is part of the equation, then you know, that raises serious concern, and we hope that the protesters will realize that while they are being heard and their right to be heard, that we all think about the broader impact and the challenges that will abound if this continues. There will be an impact. And so can we really afford that as a state? And we don't think we can afford that as a state if we want to meet our goals, if we want to promote a healthy community, healthy economy, and a more viable state that will be faced with many challenges to come. And again, as I mentioned earlier, we need to start changing the framework and the mindset of how we go through this decision-making process. We hope that this is the light at the end of the tunnel, that something will come out of it in a positive way. At least we can hope for that.
Any plans to reach out to Senate President or House Speaker?
I believe Senate President, House Speaker understands the business community's concerns about what is going on and the impact it will have on, you know, on Hawaii investment in Hawaii. And we hope that government leaders, whether it's the governor or the mayor, call a meeting, as well as if we can all come together. And if there is a call again for us to be part of that, we will be there. You know, we've expressed over and over that investment is needed in Hawaii, and any efforts to undermine efforts to address the cost of doing business as well as the cost of living is a concern for the business community.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you so much, Sherry. Really appreciate you making time for us.
Absolutely.
That was Sherry Minor McNamara of the Chamber of Commerce talking about the potential business backlash as we see the stepped-up protests happening across the state. This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, your backyard quiz. In today's backyard quiz, we're looking for the name of a notable rock formation near Sunset Beach. Its Hawaiian name comes from the tale of a surfer who came to Oahu's North Shore from Kauai. The adventurous surfer would ask the seabirds each day where he could find the most challenging surf. One day, the birds brought him a lehualei and said it was from a beautiful maiden. He went to her cave and they married. From then on, every morning she would give him a lehualei, which he would wear all day until returning home. But one day, the story goes, he came back wearing an alimalei, which was given to him by a girl on the beach. Furious, his wife called on her amakua to punish him, and they turned him to stone. More recently, it's been called by another name because it looks like a certain president of the United States. Do you know what the stone is? Call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. If you think you know the answer, the first one to get it right gets a reusable tote bag that tells people you got it right.
I'm Stephen Dubner on the next Freakonomics Radio, the man who many people believe to be singularly responsible for Brexit.
Was it the right campaign? Was it the right renegotiation? Was it the right timing? And I think I probably got some of those wrong.
Former British Prime Minister David Cameron on Brexit and his relations with other world leaders.
I found in the end I just couldn't trust what he was saying.
That's next time on Freakonomics Radio.
Tonight at 7, following Counterspin.
Aloha, I'm Drew from Paradise Cove. You're listening to The Conversation on member-supported Hawaii Public Radio.
Starting today, the guide to the International Film Festival should be available at Starbucks coffee shops around town. We talked to Becky Stracchetti about what's in store as buzz around the offerings this year starts to build.
We have an incredible lineup this year at the 39th Hawaii International Film Festival. I couldn't be more excited to be talking to you and to be telling everyone about this lineup. I mean, I know every year I say we have an incredible lineup, but this year it's such an amazing lineup and really, really great films from all over the world. So we're excited.
And you've got some kind of new areas you're venturing into.
Yeah, we have a lot of new areas. So we have a really incredible European program this year. We've renamed sort of our awards buzz section, which are films that we expect you to see, you know, nominated for an Oscar or something like that. We've renamed it our premiere section, and then we have incredible films in that, a ton of really, really big titles, and we also have really big European titles, and I can go into more detail on any of those. And then we also have a renewed partnership with the Vilcek Foundation that highlights immigrant filmmakers, which is, of course, a really big issue right now. And we're excited to be celebrating these contributions to the cinematic arts throughout the United States. But even more than that, it's also really personally exciting, given that this year we're actually able to honor five immigrant filmmakers who are also women of color. So that's really exciting for us. And they will all be here and doing panels and showing their films. One of those filmmakers is Haifa Al-Mansour. And she is an Oscar-nominated filmmaker for the film Wajida that came out a few years ago. And we're showing her film that's brand new, that just premiered. It played at Venice and at Toronto International Film Festival.
What's that one about?
It's called The Perfect Candidate. And it's about a woman running for office in the Middle East. Haifa is the first ever female filmmaker to come out of Saudi Arabia.
Yeah, there are lots of women's issues when we're talking about that country. So it'll be interesting to see it from that perspective.
Yeah, we're really excited to have her. And like I said, one of her last films was Oscar nominated. She does incredible work in the U.S. She's a producer and a director on television shows, big stuff you've seen on HBO and on Netflix and stuff like that. So we're thrilled to have her at the festival as well. And as part of the Vilcek program, you know, she'll be speaking and doing a panel and a keynote. So.
All right. So what else is new?
Oh, my gosh. You know, another screening we're excited about is a film called The Report, also sort of in this like political spectrum. It's directed by Scott Burns, and the film features Adam Driver leading an all-star cast as an idealistic Senate staffer named Daniel Jones, who is tasked to lead an investigation into the CIA's post 9/11 detention and interrogation program. So this is like an exciting sort of thriller, political drama that will sort of remind you of the best of the like 70s era political dramas that have come out. You know, it is looking at issues of corruption, justice, that type of thing that I think, you know, will hit a lot of tones as far as what's happening in the political spectrum in the U.S. today as well.
So you've checked off the newsy box,
I know.
Right?
So we got a lot of newsy films. We also have, I know, while I'm on this, thread, we have a documentary. We have a really amazing documentary program, too, that's supported by Civil Beat that we're excited about. We're showing this documentary called The Human Factor, which is behind the scenes about how the United States negotiated the peace between Israel and its neighbors. So it shows really, it's basically like you're a fly in the wall in these negotiations and conversations with President Clinton and the leaders of Israel and Palestine over the last 25 years.
And it's a documentary.
That's a documentary, yeah.
Wow. So they basically got this film footage and
Lot of interviews now, yeah. Yeah, current contemporary interviews as well. And we will have a panel with the Davis Levin Livingston Law Firm to talk about some interesting issues there, too. So a lot of our films have these really great panels and talkbacks and stuff as a part of the festival, which is something that we're really proud of and always trying to tell people about, that it's not just an opportunity to see these films that you might have an opportunity to see somewhere on Netflix or Amazon or a streaming service like that later, but we go, you know, so much farther. We have the filmmakers come out. We have local experts coming to talk about all the issues. Sometimes we even have celebrity talent as well that will come and do a panel. This year, one of the celebrities we're really excited to be bringing out to the festival is John Woo, who is one of the most famous and sort of the grandfather of martial arts cinema. He's originally from Hong Kong, and I mean, pretty much every sort of karate film that you see today has a some sort of its themes can be traced back to John Woo. He was
a big influence.
Yeah, the OG, if you will. And we're showing the 30th anniversary of his film, The Killer, which I can't believe it's 30 years old already. And he will be here and we'll do an extended Q&A afterwards. And he's worked with everyone. I mean, he has worked with Jackie Chan, all the big stars coming out of Asia.
Well, he's just incredible. You're going to get a good draw for that one.
Yeah, I hope so. And, you know, it's funny that you mentioned that. Like, there's so many films that I think we're going to get great draws for, but this year, more than ever, and I really want to impress this, is, like, a lot of the companies that we contract with to be able to show these films are really limiting it. So a lot of the really, really big films that we have, we're only allowed to show once or twice. So, you know, definitely if you're interested in some stuff, get your tickets early, because companies are being much more selective over when and how many people can watch them in advance. So,
it's a great opportunity for
film buffs. It's an amazing opportunity for film buffs, and you are going to see these way before anyone else has any chance to see them. You know, our opening film, Jojo Rabbit, is getting incredible press and reviews around the world. It's by Taika Waititi, that most people in Hawaii have heard of him. He's a director well known for What We Do in the Shadows, and then he moved to Marvel and directed Thor, that came out a couple years ago. And he's been, you know, a festival favorite. He's been to the festival a number of times, even way before he was ever famous. And this is his latest work that he's been working on for years. It's a really interesting, controversial film about the Third Reich and Hitler, but it's also a comedy. And, you know, the story goes is that Taika couldn't find anyone to play Hitler in the film, so he plays Hitler himself. Oh. So it's interesting. And it did really, really well in Toronto. Taika, of course, will be here for opening night as well.
And so tell us what's happening with virtual reality.
Oh, my gosh. I'm so glad you asked. We have a really incredible virtual reality program. So we started our VR exhibit last year. That was the first time we ever did it. And it was only 3 days. We only had 4 projects that were a part of it. And the whole thing happened at the barn at Saltadar Kaka'ako, in that big open space. So this year, it was such a success last year that we've actually expanded it a lot this year. So this year it will take place again at the barn, but over 5 days. And then an additionally to that, we have the sandbox, the entrepreneur sandbox that just opened up.
Yes.
Yeah. It just opened up last week, over just about a 5-minute walk away from where Salt is. It's like closer to the water over there, next to the medical school. So that space is good because it's indoor, which means it's climate controlled. So it's air conditioned. So we're able to use a little bit of higher end technology in there. So those are our 2 spaces. They're both still free and open to the public. We do take reservations online for those spaces as well. And we have over 20 projects. We have a handful of guests coming that will be doing panels about virtual reality. We're showing a spotlight on Taiwanese virtual reality projects that we're really excited about. Taiwan is doing really interesting, super cutting edge things with VR right now. So we have a couple of films, or I'm sorry, a couple of projects from Taiwan. We also have a special program of virtual reality that spotlights Indigenous Australian work. So really interestingly looking at ways that you can use this new technology and this new narrative form to look at Indigenous issues and, you know, sort of preserve 60,000 years of cultural history, how to sort of move into the future with that as well. So we're really, really excited about that. And you know, I hope in the next couple of years we're able to see more projects coming out of Hawaii that we can showcase as well. So, you know, in that same breath, we are doing a special sort of open screening of local XR and VR projects one of the nights. And that will run November 8th through the 12th.
Okay, so that's a great chance to showcase our local talent.
Yeah. Oh, sorry, one more. We're doing a spotlight on this animation VR from a studio called Baobab, and they have these really amazing animations, a lot of which are around sort of meeting aliens for the first time and that type of thing. And, you know, virtual reality is a really fun, totally new, different sort of experience. And as HIF and as we, you know, are so well known for showcasing film, what excites me the most about this is the new ways that people can experience film and media, and the different type of reactions that it provokes in audiences and in people that have the opportunity to experience it. And there really aren't that many opportunities in Hawaii to do that. Sometimes you can see a few projects at a museum, or, you know, there's a new like VR escape room that opened up over in Kaka'ako. But as far as how independent voices and international media makers are really using this technology in very different ways, outside of gaming and outside of sort of historical purposes, really trying to think about different ways to make narratives work within an individual context.
So there's experimentation going on with this.
Yeah, yeah, it's experimentation, and it's like a different way to really be literally inside of the film. You know what I mean? The really individual experience, and then, you know, being able to go through that with a group of people is really cool, because then you can talk about it afterwards.
Yeah, I just love the innovation, because I remember when the film Inception came out.
Right.
And you're like, whoa.
Right. Yeah, exactly. You know, Inception, or, you know, even like The Matrix,
yes,
where you're thinking about like how to download a lot of information, you know. So it's fun and it's new and it's interesting, and there's so much potential with it. And, you know, we really hope to kind of inspire the local community also as part of this to both experience the technology and also, you know, hopefully make some at some point. And we're trying to make it easier for people here to do that. We have this incredible film community here. We have an incredible radio community, and journalist community. And so this is really the next step, I think. Can I say one
yes.
more thing? As part of the VR program, we also have a VR dinner. That's going to be really cool. It's super limited. There's only 50 seats available, but it's a 3-course meal with real food and 2 cocktails. And you have a VR experience that goes along with every course.
Ooh,
I know.
That's interesting.
It's super cool. The chefs are from New York and LA, and they also did the VR technology, and it's just going to be a trip for sure.
Okay, limited seats, so act quickly. Thanks so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
That was Becky Struchetti talking about the upcoming Hawaii International Film Festival. It runs November 7th to the 24th on Oahu, Maui, and the Big Island. For links to the online film guide, you can check our website, hawaiipublicradio.org.
When Ira Glass created This American Life, he revolutionized auditory storytelling. Now's your chance to see and hear him in person. Join HPR and Hawaii Theater Center Saturday, December 21st for Ira Glass's one-man show, his first performance ever in Hawaii, plus a Q&A with the audience. We're giving HPR members early access to the best seats now before they open to the general public. Get yours at hprtickets.org.
In this current political climate, some Pacific Islanders are going to great lengths to get their immigration papers in order. That is the subject of today's reality check. Honolulu Civil Beats reporter Anita Hofschneider is on the line today. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
So your story really talks about some crazy red tape.
Yeah, it is. It was quite interesting and surprising to learn about the lengths that people go to actually get some copies of these immigration documents. They, you know, as I wrote about, there are people who are actually crossing the U.S.-Mexico border, sometimes the U.S.-Canada border, all just to be able to get a copy of a document that they need in order to prove that they can work legally here in the U.S.
Yeah, so talk about this form.
Yeah, so it's called the I-94 form. And for those who don't know, for some listeners who may not know, the U.S. has treaties with governments in the Pacific, Palau, the Marshall Islands, and the Federated States of Micronesia, and their citizens are able to live and work in the U.S. indefinitely. And this is under strategic military agreements that give the U.S. control over much of the Western Pacific and kind of act as a buffer between Hawaii and North Korea or other potential adversaries. But although there are thousands who live in the U.S. legally, many can't get jobs, housing, a driver's license, or even health insurance without this one piece of paper, and it's an immigration document called the I-94. So prior to 2012, you would come into the U.S. and you would get this paper inserted into your passport. Because this community, they don't need visas, they don't need green cards to be here. It's legal for them to be here under these treaties. But they do need to have this particular form because many times employers will ask for it, or sometimes even landlords, especially if you are looking for subsidies, will ask for it. And if you need to get a driver's license, you definitely need to have this I-94. And there are a couple different problems with this. You know, on one hand, some people might just simply lose this. But on the other hand, not everyone receives it. If you arrived as an infant, you might not have your own I-94. Also, if you arrived post-2012, it would be entered into an online system. But now people are finding that the information is no longer accessible after 5 years. And so they arrived and they thought that their information was in this online system. But 5 years later, they suddenly can't access it.
That's crazy.
For whatever reason, you know, people are finding that they lost this key document and they're having a really, really hard time getting it replaced.
I mean, it just seems maddening that it's so difficult to obtain or, you know, to get a new copy if you need it.
Exactly. You know, it costs $445 to replace it. And, you know, that is typical for a lot of immigration documents. But, for example, a green card costs more than $500 to replace. But you can apply for a fee waiver if you are low income. And there is no fee waiver option for the I-94. It also takes several months to get. So if you are, you know, trying to get a job and they say, oh, we need to proof right away that you can be here legally, you might not have the luxury of waiting 5 months to get a replacement. You might need it within 2 weeks. And so that's where some people are finding that traveling is actually, you know, much quicker. And sometimes it's even cheaper if you are living in Texas or in Arizona. It's easier and quicker to drive down to the border, you know, cross the U.S.-Mexico border and come back in. You get the I-94 for free upon entry, and you don't have to worry about paying that $445 fee for something that, you know, you're waiting months for and maybe it won't ever come in.
So you're actually hearing stories of people that would just go driving long distances just to get it instantly.
Exactly. I mean, here in Hawaii, I actually talked to one Hawaii resident who wasn't, she wasn't able to work. She really wanted to work. She really wanted to actually even take a GED course. She, you know, her dream is to one day become a nurse, but she wasn't able to take the GED course or even get a job without this form. And she had arrived as a 9-year-old. And so, you know, she didn't know at 9 years old that this form was important. And, her family moved around a lot. It got lost. And so she ended up having a cousin in Texas who paid for her to fly to Dallas and then drove her all the way down to the border and then drove her back in order to get one. And on the mainland, I'm discovering this is actually quite common. In Arkansas, there's a group of a Marshallese advocacy group that actually plans monthly trips because the demand is so great. They make people sign liability forms, acknowledging the risks, like they might not be let back into the U.S. They make them say, reveal if they have any like criminal background that could potentially make them be stuck at the border. And so far they haven't had any, they've had a couple of close calls, but they haven't had anybody not be able to get back in because they do this thorough check about, you know, how, whether your passport's up to date, and they make sure that you can go on this trip and help you get that I-94.
So it's kind of a caravan of a different type, but what does the Customs and Border Protection say about, you know, why this form is so expensive and so difficult to get?
You know, unfortunately, I was not able to get an interview with them. I did my best, but they didn't have anyone available, and they weren't really able to answer that question about the, you know, why there's no fee, as well as why there's a 5-year limit on accessing, you know, the form online. I think, you know, since that was implemented back in 2012, 2013, just now, 5 years later, people are finding, oh, no, this form I thought was online is no longer there. I need to print it out and save it, and this is really important. Otherwise, I could be blocked from things. And, you know, I talked to local service providers here in Hawaii who say that this form and the difficulty of replacing it is directly correlates to increased homelessness here in Hawaii. You know, people aren't able to get jobs, and so then they aren't able to keep their housing. They become homeless, and then they're ineligible for certain subsidies because they don't have this. And it's just like this, you know, terrible confluence of all of these things. And so I think that it would actually quite help the situation here in Hawaii if it were easier for people to, you know, get replacements for these things, and if there were a fee waiver, and if it weren't so expensive.
Yeah, well, that was a real eye-opener. Thanks so much for that story.
Thank you for having me.
That was reporter Anita Hofschneider with today's Reality Check. To read her full story, visit civilbeat.org.
Support for The Conversation comes from PBS Hawaii, presenting live What's It Going to Take?, an executive forum on making life better in Hawaii, 8 p.m. this Thursday, pbshawaii.org.
In today's backyard quiz, we were looking for a rock near Sunset Beach. It was named for a surfer whose wife gave him a lehua lei every day, and the loyal husband would be wearing it when he returned. One day, however, he accepted an alima lei from a girl at the beach, and he wore it home, and his wife became angry as she called on her amakua to punish him. Walking up the hill towards their cave, he looked back at the surf one last time before, the story goes, he was turned to stone. This Hawaiian story of Kahikilani has faded, although some say it's been called the Washington Stone for its resemblance to the first president of the United States. The Hawaii Visitors and Convention Bureau once had a sign along Kamehameha Highway to help locate the stone, but the sign has been removed, and the stone area is now overgrown and difficult to see from the road. That's today's quiz. If you have an idea for one, send it to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Crunch a cricket. Dare you to do it. Well, tomorrow happens to be World Edible Insect Day. And back on October 23rd, 2015, Belgian entrepreneur Chris de Ruyter launched WEI Day to raise global awareness about eating edible insects. There was a focus on Europe, North America, and Australia. Now, with the increase in population and the increasing effects of climate change, there is a possibility, some believe, that people's food supply will become more difficult to meet. So you need some coaxing to consume a cricket. Here's Lourdes Torres from Sustainable Boost to talk about her Kauai cricket farm.
So our mission is to farm crickets and provide them to our customers dehydrated, flavored as a snack, and in a powder form so that they can include it in their smoothies, in their oatmeals, in their yogurts, in their baking. Like, you can put it in banana bread, you can put it in chocolate chip cookies. And it seemed to us like that would have been a much easier way to get to our customer base as opposed to with a restaurant. So we're putting that on the back burner a little bit and doing a little more educating.
Mm-hmm. So you were really looking at this as another source of protein.
Yes. And not only protein, because it has a little bit more protein than cattle, but it has incredible amounts of vitamin B12. It has all the vitamin B12 you need in a day. It has 10 times more omegas than salmon. And it also has 4 times more magnesium than cattle. So it is super nutritionally dense. And one of the things that people are learning is that it has a ton of prebiotics. And it comes from the exoskeleton, very similar to shrimp and lobster, and is made up of something called chitin. And again, it's a very powerful prebiotic.
So what does it taste like?
So the ones that are not flavored, they taste like sunflower seed. They have a really nice, mild, nutty flavor that people seem to enjoy and be really surprised by how mild the flavor is and how easy they are to eat. They're like really quite delicious and quite enjoyable.
So you can really just add it to anything to give you a boost.
A sustainable boost. Yes, that's my company name. You're going to be giving your everyday foods a incredible boost of nutrition. And whether you have a kitchen or whether you cook or not, it doesn't matter, because it is truly an amazing way to just add a ton of nutrition that is low impact, right, to boot, is very sustainable source of food to almost anything you eat. So your everyday foods, right? You don't have to have a specific diet, like if you're a keto diet or whatever diet you're on, it doesn't really matter, and it doesn't matter what you eat. Whatever you're going to be eating, if you want to put it in your pancake batter and in your pancakes in the morning, that would be perfect.
Now,
and we all love pancakes.
Mm-hmm. My only experience with crickets is when I had to buy some in order to feed a Jackson chameleon that my daughter had found. And then I ended up with a house full of crickets running around because I think my son forgot to put the lid on the jar.
Oh, my goodness. And they escaped?
Yes.
That is hilarious. You know what? That's how we have been farming them in the United States for decades. They have been for reptile food and for fishing bait. But it wasn't until a few years ago that the FDA recognized them as food, and we now are beginning to farm them for human consumption. There are almost 2,000 insects that are considered edible right now. And we farm the what's called a house cricket and the Acheta domesticus. So we farm two.
So tell us about this chance that people will get to sample some of your crickets.
Yes, so we're so excited to be hosting our very first World Edible Insect Day banquet. So World Edible Insect Day is being celebrated globally on October 23rd. And my team member, Amber Long, has prepared a banquet where we do the farmers market, because I have a presence on Oahu every week where we do farmers markets. And she has enlisted 7 chefs to use the hydrated crickets or the powdered. So we blend them and grind them up into powder, and then we have the dehydrated ones. And all 7 of them are going to be featuring a new food with the star ingredient being crickets. This Wednesday and Saturday, it's both days.
So what do they eat?
So they have a plant-based diet. And they love something called Pacific spinach, which we grow for them. And they absolutely, it's their favorite. But they also love banana leaves and pumpkin leaves. And just a side note, the Pacific spinach that we grow for them, we also blend it and dehydrate it and sell it as one of our plant proteins, because Pacific spinach is recognized as the second most nutritious leafy green on the planet, but the one that contains the most proteins. So yeah, we use it both. At our farm, we farm it for both, for human consumption and to feed the crickets.
So are they fairly easy to raise?
Well, it depends on what you call easy, right? They require a lot of attention around the clock, and it all depends how big you're planning to scale up. So I have 2 schools on the island, and I would like to give a shout-out to these 2 amazing people, one Greg Anderson of Kauai High, who is about to have students from the school, from the high school, start their cricket farm. And I'm going to be providing the eggs and the habitat. And then I will be buying the crickets that they farm back from them at, you know, the market rate. And then the Wilcox Elementary School, I want to give a shout out to Natsumi Yamasato. She's a teacher there, And she met me at an event, and she also is going to start farming crickets and got a grant approved for, you know, the expense. And she told me she was going to do hydroponics. And then when she heard about my crickets, she thought it would be really interesting and super exciting to try crickets. So she's going to be doing that next month. Both schools are going to be doing it next month.
Okay, and
so we're about to find out how the students do with it, and we're going to start small. So if you start small, you know, it's relatively easy.
What's the lifespan of a cricket?
About 2 months.
Two months.
So from when they're eggs to ready to be harvested, it's about 60 days.
Okay. All right. So your whole mission then is to share crickets with the world on Insect Day.
Yes, yes. And to help people with their ick factor. There's a tremendous amount of ick factor surrounding eating not only crickets, but insects. And we haven't been conditioned to think that they're food. But if we think about shrimp and lobster, right, which are not swimming in the ocean, they're crawling down there, we have been conditioned to think that that's food. And similarly, I think that there'll come a day where we will think of insects as food and be as excited as we are, as some people are, about shrimp and lobster. So I am pioneering my way and paving the way for other farmers after me to be able to farm crickets and it'd be super acceptable and now raise so many eyebrows.
Well, now, when you were a little kid, did someone ever dare you to eat a bug?
Yes, because I was born and raised in New York City, but I spent all my childhood growing up in my grandmother's farm in Puerto Rico. And so she was the first one to point out to a certain insects and said, hey, that's food. And we thought, sure, Grandma, if there was salmon, you know, at the time, we would all giggle. but I understand her. And it was the first introduction I had to insects. And at the time, yes, we dared each other to eat all kinds of creepy crawlers. Yes, my cousins and I.
You have kids? Do they eat crickets too?
Yes, yes. They eat it in their smoothies and in their pancakes and in their cookies.
Mm-hmm. Well, good. So we'll have to look out for you then on the 23rd and 26th.
It would be wonderful. I want to say that I am going to have a little team on a booth doing the cricket challenge. And we have some really cool special prizes for those who dare to eat a cricket and who are bold and brave enough. And I also want to give a shout out to Michael of Passion Bakery, who is the individual who developed the flavors, the three flavors that we're going to unveil on the 23rd and the 26th. I will be there on Saturday the 26th, and I am looking forward to seeing, you know, all of my brothers and sisters on Kauai and Hawaii and Oahu. Line up to try a cricket first time, or those who have had it before will be proud of having one that's raised on Hawaii.
Okay, well, thanks so much. Thanks for agreeing to talk to us.
Yeah, it was my pleasure. Thanks for having me. Have a great day.
That was Lourdes Torres, whose company Sustainable Boost is rolling out some new flavored crickets. How does wasabi or honey nut grab you? Would you brave a bug banquet? Ick factor? Well, get over it. And to help you get past that ick factor, consider sampling a cricket tomorrow, which is World Edible Insect Day. Take the cricket challenge. Double dare ya. Crickets will be available at the Kaka'ako Farmers Market tomorrow and Saturday.
Lots of companies are criticized for not being diverse enough and have spent a ton of money trying and failing to fix the problem.
If it's not rooted in the main of the corporate structure, the chances are it's not going to work.
I'm Kai Rizdal, trying and failing to get diversity right, next time on Marketplace.
This evening at 6, following All Things Considered.
We are all out of time. Up tomorrow, we take a closer look at possible future farmers in our high schools. Tell us what's on your mind. Call or talk back line. Leave us your comments. Call 808-792-8217. Email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. We are on Facebook at The Conversation HPR and Twitter at HI Conversation. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow for more of The Conversation, Hawaii Talks.